Edna, Felipe said urgently. What is scarier, the darkness or a bomb falling on your head? I let them drag me down into the suffocating blackness. As I sank into the cramped space, the sound of my heartbeat seemed unnaturally loud. I scrambled across the dirt floor to find a corner, and then I wrapped my arms around my knees. When the next round of echoing booms began to sound, I shrieked involuntarily with each one. Soon enough, I was in a fetal position against the dirt floor, my hands over my ears. A particularly loud explosion rocked the whole cellar, and as dust rained down on us, I found myself sobbing in fear. Was that our house? I choked in a moment of silence.
No, Father said, his tone gently scolding. We will know it if the house goes. It is Shepinia. They are probably taking out the rail line, maybe the industrial buildings. There is no reason for them to destroy our homes. We are likely safe, but we will hide in here until it stops, just to be sure.
Felipe and Stanislav shifted to sit on either side of me, and then the cellar was again filled with a stifling silence as we all waited for the next explosion. Instead, we were surprised by a more welcome sound.
Hello?
A distant, muffled voice called.
Mama? Father?
Mama cried out in delight and opened the hatch, then climbed up to help my sister, Truda, and her husband, Mateusz, into the cellar. To my immense relief, Father turned an oil lamp on to help them see their way. Once we were all safely inside the cellar again, Mama and Truda embraced.
What do we do now? I asked breathlessly.
Everyone turned to look at me.
We wait, Mama murmured, and we pray.
We spent much of that first day huddled together, hidden in the cellar beneath the barn. The planes came and went and came back again. Later, we would learn that several hundred bombs were dropped across our region during those long hours we spent hiding. The bombing was sporadic, unpredictable, and fierce. From my position in the cellar, the explosions near and far and all around us sounded like the end of the world was happening just outside of our barn. Most people have no idea what prolonged terror really feels like. I certainly didn't until that day. In that terrifying darkness, I sweated through hours and hours and hours of being certain that any second a bomb would fall on us, that any second the cellar would cave in, that any second a man with a gun would appear in the doorway to take away my life. I had not been comfortable with confined spaces even at the best of times, but that day I felt a depth of fear that I'd never even realized was possible. I lived my death that day, over and over and over again in my mind. Extreme anxiety like that doesn't obey the normal laws of emotion. It doesn't get tired. It doesn't fade. You never grow used to it. I was every bit as petrified 8 hours into those airstrikes as I was when they began, until I was entirely convinced that the only end for the fear would be the end of life itself. There was an extended break in the bombing early in the afternoon. We didn't dare breathe a sigh of relief at first, because there had been breaks earlier in the day, but they hadn't lasted long. This time, long minutes went past, and after a while, even the sound of plane engines faded away into blessed silence. Felipe was desperate to run next door to check on Justina and her family. It was only a few hundred feet. He assured us he'd hide in the tree line along the woods, and he'd be back in less than half an hour. Mama and Father grumbled, but eventually allowed him to go. And predictably, as soon as permission had been granted, Stanislav decided he was going too. The rest of us climbed into the doorway of the barn for some fresh air, and with the sky still clear, we remained there until the twins returned. Father and Mateusz sat in the doorway. Mama, Truda, and I sat in a line behind them. Truda and Mama talked quietly as we waited. But I sat silent, my mouth too dry for small talk. As promised, my brothers were gone for less than half an hour, but they returned visibly shaken, and at first I thought they'd discovered the worst.
They joined us in the barn, sitting against the doorposts on either side of Father and Mateusz. There was some good news. The Goloshevsky family were fine and, like us, were physically unscathed. But Jan had made a trip into Chebinje during the last brief bombing break. He had seen locals walking the streets, weeping the loss of their families. Children with injuries so bad, Felipe couldn't bear to repeat the details, and dozens of homes alight. During my hours in the cellar, I had been so consumed with anxiety that my own safety had monopolized my thoughts. But as my brother relayed Jan's findings, another fear broke through. I was rapidly processing the implications of what a severely damaged Chebinje could mean, and the risk to Alexei and Emilia. The medical clinic was just off the town square, right where the homes were densest. And if they were dead, that would mean that one day soon, Tomas would return and there'd be no family waiting for him. Suddenly, all roads led to the impact of this potential development on Tomas.
Alexei,
I croaked. Everyone shifted to stare at me, and I saw the sadness in their eyes.
Alexei and Emilia have to be okay. They have to be.
If Alexei is okay, he will be tending to the injured,
Mama murmured. I could imagine that. Alexei hiding during the bombing, then emerging to help the wounded. But if that was true, who was comforting and protecting Emilia? I had been riding out the bombing raids surrounded by my whole family, and it was still the most terrifying experience of my life. She was 7 years old, and with Tomas away, she only had her father. So if he was busy or even injured himself...
We have to get Emilia,
I blurted, and Felipe sighed impatiently.
How? Who knows when the planes will return?
But if Alexei is busy helping people, who will be with her? She might be alone. Please, Father, please, Mama, we have to do something.
There is nothing we can do, Alina, Father said softly. I am sorry. What will be, will be. We will pray, Mama announced. It is all we can do.
No, I said, and I shook my head fiercely. You must go get her, Father. You must. She's a baby, all alone in the world. She is my family, too. Please.
Alina, Truda groaned.
You are asking for the impossible. It's not safe for anyone to go into the town.
I couldn't let the matter drop, not even when my parents' pleas for silence became sharp demands for me to drop the matter. When I started to cry and threatened to make the journey myself, Felipe pulled himself up from the dirt and dusted his trousers off. Mama groaned.
Don't be foolish, Felipe. You have tempted fate once already.
Alina is right, Mama. Aren't we worse than the Nazis if we leave that little girl to fend for herself where her father works to save lives?
If she's even alive, Felipe, you may get to the town and find they are already gone,
Father said under his breath.
Father, don't say such a thing, I gasped.
I'll go too, Stanny sighed.
I think I should go too, Mateusz said quietly.
It was Truda's turn for an outraged gasp, until he added gently,
I will check on our home while we are on our way to the clinic. The boys and I will move fast and will be careful. We can come straight back if we hear the planes returning. You know yourself it only took us 10 minutes to get here yesterday.
Mama cursed furiously and threw her hands in the air.
You are trying to kill me, boys! You have tempted fate once already and survived. Now you are just trying to make my heart stop beating from the fear.
Mama, we are just doing what you raised us to do, Felipe said stiffly. We are trying to do the right thing.
But what if the bombing starts again?
Faustina, Mateusz said more firmly now, you have heard the explosions just as I have. They are coming from every direction. Even to the west, where there is nothing but farmhouses, the planes are not just targeting the town. We are no safer here than we will be in the town.
There was no arguing with that, and they left soon after. Although my father instructed them to run up the hill and to hide in the woods for a few minutes to be sure there were no more planes on the horizon before they exposed themselves in the clearing on the other side. As soon as the younger men had left, my sister and my parents fixed accusing gazes on me, and I felt myself flushing. It suddenly, belatedly occurred to me that I had convinced my own brothers and my brother-in-law to risk their lives, all in the hope that I could save Tomas from grief. But I loved Amelia and Alexei, and I was genuinely afraid for their safety. I didn't regret convincing my brothers to go check on them. I was just deathly afraid that I'd just manipulated my way into an unimaginable loss. I tried to explain myself to my remaining family members. It's better that you do not speak until they return, Truda interrupted me flatly.
You sit there, Alina Dziak, and you focus your energies on praying that you have not just killed our brothers and my husband.
That's exactly what I did. The first time my brothers left the cellar, the minutes dragged by, but this was a whole new level of torture. In the end, the silence was punctuated by a different sound, the sound of a child wailing. We all ran out of the barn and found the twins walking side by side down from the hill, Mateusz following closely behind with Emilia high in his arms. She was sobbing loudly and inconsolably.
Oh, Babisu,
my sister cried, and she ran from the barn to her husband's side. He gently passed Emilia to Truda's waiting arms, and Truda immediately began to console the little girl.
Shh, shh, shh. It's okay, little one. You will be okay now.
Once they were within the coverage of the barn, my mother walked to Truda's side and ran a gentle hand down Amelia's cheek. Then she raised her gaze to mine. Mama was clearly very sad, but also thoughtful as she stared at me. I was quickly distracted from Mama's gaze by Amelia's continuing sobs. I turned my attention to my brothers, and Felipe shook his head hastily.
Alexei is fine. The clinic is fine too, other than some broken windows. But there are injured people in Alexei's home, and worse, a line of people waiting for help all along the street.
Mateusz approached me and spoke very carefully, his voice low and soft.
Emilia saw one of her school friends hurt. She ran off and hid in a cupboard. Alexei said the wounded have been coming to the house since the bombing started, and he didn't have time to comfort her. He was very grateful. He asked if we could keep her until things are safer. It might be some days.
Of course we can,
Mama murmured quietly. She took Emilia from Truda and held her for a moment, then passed the little girl to me. Truda and Mateusz embraced, and my mother began to kiss my brothers all over their faces.
You are too brave for your own good.
Emilia wrapped her arms around my neck. She pressed her tear-stained face against my shoulder. Her entire body was shaking, and she was breathing noisily between her sobs.
Alina, the noise was so loud. There was a bomb on Mr. Erickson's shop, and our house rattled, and the glass all broke.
I know.
And Maya from school was asleep, and her mother was shouting, and father couldn't wake her up, and I don't understand why there was so much blood on her face. Why was there so much blood?
Hush now, Mama murmured.
Truda approached me, her concerned gaze fixed on Emilia. She slid her arm around my shoulders and gently pulled me to the ground, curling up beside me. I settled Emilia across our laps, and as I stroked Emilia's back, Truda began to sing. Mama sat opposite us, watching closely.
Just rest, little one, Mama said softly. You are safe now.
But what about Tomas?
She croaked, her little voice weak and uneven still.
He is all alone in Warsaw. What will happen to my brother?
No one said anything, and I tensed, then rushed to comfort her. Or maybe I was trying to comfort myself.
Warsaw is so far away, I said firmly. Planes probably can't even fly that far. It is better that he isn't here, Amelia. He will surely be safer there.
Over the days that followed, we took turns crowding around Father's wireless to listen to the news updates. His set was a crystal unit the twins had constructed a few years earlier, and that meant only one person at a time could listen on the tinny headsets. I jostled for my turn like everyone else, but I always regretted those moments I spent at the wireless, because the news was never comforting. Entire cities were being destroyed, but the small stories hurt the most. We heard endless tales of farmers shot in their fields from machine guns on planes, and even one horrific story about a grandfather who was harvesting the last of his vegetables when a pilot dropped a bomb right on him. That story spoke volumes to me about the might of the invaders and the way our country was outgunned. We were simply peasants standing in dirt, totally defenseless against massive explosives dropped from airborne war machines by unfathomably hate-filled pilots. There were Nazi troops in our district within days of the bombing, because the local army defenses were quickly overcome. After that, the bombing stopped, but there were still more planes. Only now they flew over us, but they didn't fly back. And somehow, that was even worse. Soon the trucks started coming, rumbling through the town, not yet stopping, but promising just by their presence that one day soon, everything left intact after the bombing was going to be broken anyway. The men from my family made another trip into town and again returned sullen.
"There are notices hung everywhere," Father murmured. "There is a town meeting tomorrow at noon, and we all must attend."
Mateusz flickered his gaze to Truda.
"We must go home tonight, my love. Perhaps if we are at the house, we can protect it."
"Protect it from the Nazis?" she asked, somewhat incredulously. "With what? Our bare hands?"
"An empty house in the town is vulnerable, Truda," he said. "Besides, the Nazis have breached the national border. Do you think that little hill is going to contain them? Now that the bombing has stopped, we are no safer here than we will be there."
"Did you see my father?"
Emilia asked. Her voice was very small. She seemed to be shrinking by the hour, despite close attention from my sister, my mother, and myself. Mateusz and Father both shook their heads.
"Your father is still very busy helping people, but he is fine," Mama said abruptly. "Alina, entertain the child. Let the adults talk."
We retreated into my bedroom and sat on my sofa, and I tried to play one of the counting games Emilia was so fond of, while simultaneously straining to eavesdrop on the conversation in the main part of the house.
"Everything is going to be okay, isn't it, Alina?"
Emilia asked me suddenly. She looked terrified, her huge green eyes wide within the frame of her pale face. I forced myself to smile.
"Of course, little sister. Everything is going to be just fine."
After a sleepless night, we made our way into the town square on foot. We walked along the road instead of up through the woods and over the hill. The road meant a longer journey, but it seemed that none of us were in a hurry to get to our destination. By the time we arrived, a crowd was already assembled at the square, waiting in a stiff, eerie silence. As we joined the group, I wedged myself between my parents, as if they could shield me from the gravity of it all. Stanislav left us to stand with Irina, the girl he was courting. Felipe had gone to seek out Justyna. Truda and Mateusz were sitting there too, but to my surprise had opted to stand with the mayor's wife and her children. I scanned my way around the assembled crowd, identifying each of the couples, and I felt dual pangs of jealousy and fear. I so wished that Tomas was there with me. I was sure everything would feel less bewildering, if only my hand was in his. Instead, I held his little sister's hand, and I scanned the crowd for Alexei. He was tall, like Tomas, so I was sure I'd find him sooner or later, and then I could point him out to comfort Emilia. I felt disconnected from it all, at a place I knew so well on a sunny day that should have been beautiful, only nothing seemed beautiful. Nothing even seemed familiar anymore. There were strangers among us, and they were somehow now in charge. And that very fact entirely warped the landscape that I had known as my home. Those men looked like statues in their stiff, impeccably pressed uniforms, with the impossible splash of red around the armband, the swastika they wore with pride. It occurred to me that the Nazi uniform removed their humanity somehow, drained them of their uniqueness, and left them a unified force of solidarity, like a solid wall encroaching upon our space. These were not even men. They were individual components of a machine that had come to destroy. The commander shouted around the square at us, entirely in German. At first, I listened only to the tone of his voice, the disdain, the aggression, the authority. But each word tightened the vice-like grip of fear in my heart. I just couldn't stand not knowing what he was saying, or even understanding why he didn't even have the simple courtesy to speak to us in our native language. After a while, I turned toward Mama, and I whispered, "What is he saying?" My mother's response was only an impatient command to hush, but soon enough, I saw her eyes widen, and for the first time I saw fear cross her face. I followed her gaze to the corner of the square, where still more soldiers pushed two prisoners forward into the center of us all, their hands tied behind their backs. I scanned their faces and felt a punch of shock as I recognized them. Our mayor was at the back, but right at the front, staring out into the crowd without fear or hesitation, was Alexei. Looking back now, I suspect a brilliant man like Alexei might have understood what his fate was. But he walked into the town square with his head held high. After scanning the crowd, his gaze landed on Emilia, and he smiled at her as if to reassure her. I tugged her to stand in front of me and wrapped my arms around her from behind. She was stiff within my arms, surely as confused as I was. Why is Alexei in trouble? He's never done a wrong thing in his entire life. Alexei lifted his smile to me, and when our eyes met, he nodded once. He seemed calm, almost serene. That's why I thought for a moment or two that everything would be okay, because Alexei was the wisest man in the town, so if he wasn't worried, why should I be? But then the commander grabbed Alexei's upper arm and he pushed him hard into the ground, and Alexei's arms were tied behind his back, so his face slammed unguarded into the granite cobblestone that lined the square. Before he could even recover, another soldier slid his hand into Alexei's hair and pulled him up until he was on his knees. Alexei could not contain a cry of pain at that, and it was all I could do not to shout out in protest too. Mama grabbed my upper arm, and when I turned to her, her gaze was locked on Emilia. "Cover her eyes," she said flatly.
"But why are they?"
I said, even as my hands rose toward Emilia's face. I heard the click of the handgun being cocked, and I looked up. Alexei's death was somehow too simple and quick to be real. One single shot to the back of his head, and then he was gone. I wanted to protest. Surely a life so big couldn't end like that, without dignity or purpose or honor. But the soldiers tossed his body to the side as if it was nothing much at all. Then they shot the mayor in the same way. I felt dizzy with the shock of it all. It was just too much to process on the fly. My own eyes had to be lying to me, because what I was seeing was entirely illogical. Alexei Shlasky was a good man, but the very things that made him so central to our township, his intelligence, his training, his natural ability to lead, also made him an immediate target. To destabilize a group of people is not at all difficult, not if you are willing to be cruel enough. You simply knock out the foundations, and a natural consequence is that the rest begins to tumble. The Nazis knew this. And that's why one of their very first tactics in Poland was to execute or imprison those likely to lead in any uprising against them. Alexei and our mayor were among the first of almost 100,000 Polish leaders and academics who would be executed under the Intelligenzaktion program during the early days of the invasion. The shock wore off too soon for Emilia, and she began shrieking at the top of her lungs. A soldier near to us turned his gun toward her, and I did the bravest and stupidest thing I'd ever done in my life, at least to that point. I pushed in front of her and I begged the guard,
Please, sir. Please. My sister is distressed. Please. I will comfort her.
And I immediately turned, not even waiting for his response. I tensed, expecting the searing pain of a bullet in my own back. But even as I did so, I locked eyes with Amelia and I pressed the palm of my hand hard over her mouth. Her eyes were wild with shock and grief, but I pressed so hard that she was struggling to breathe through her now blocked nose. The tears poured down her little face, and when I realized I was not about to be shot myself and she was finally quiet, I bent low and I whispered to her,
"Can you be silent, little sister? It is so very important."
Her little green eyes were still glazed over. She nodded, a barely perceptible movement that I noticed, but didn't entirely trust. Still, I loosened the seal of my hand over her mouth and she sucked in air, but she didn't shriek. The crowd began to disperse, but Amelia was catatonic, her eyes fixed on her father's body, crumpled alone against the stone on the other side of the square. I slid my arm around her shoulders, and I forced her to turn to my parents.
"We cannot take her, not permanently," my mother whispered to me fiercely.
"We are too old and too poor, and you are too young and on your own. The occupation will be hard, and we just don't know how."
Her voice broke, and Mama's gaze flicked to Amelia's face, and then she looked back at me, for a moment visibly stricken. But she raised her chin and she hardened her gaze as she said,
"I am sorry, Alina, but you simply must find someone else."
"I know,"
I said heavily.
"Then come straight home. This is no time to be wandering the town alone. Do you hear me?"
Frankly, I couldn't believe they would leave me alone in the town at all after what we'd just seen. So I gave a shocked protest.
"Mama, surely your father will stay and help?"
"We have work that needs doing at home. It cannot wait," she said.
I didn't dare protest further because she was clearly determined. I looked around for my brothers, but both had already left with their girlfriends. And then Mama walked off too, dragging a visibly reluctant father behind her. I stared into the dispersing crowd as I learned for the first time the way it felt to force someone else's welfare to a higher priority than your own instinct for safety. I wanted to crumble and sob, or better still, run after my parents like the frightened child they knew me to be. Instead, I wrapped my arm around Amelia's shoulders and together we started to walk.
"Alina?"
Amelia said thickly when we were some distance from the square.
"Yes, little sister." "My father," she said.
Then her teeth started to chatter.
"My father is gone. The man put the gun on his head and..."
"He is gone.
But you, my darling girl, you are still here,"
I interrupted her.
"But you mustn't be afraid, Amelia,
because I am going to find a way to keep you safe until Tomas returns."
Chapter 5. Alina. As Amelia and I walked from the square, I realized with a heavy heart that if Mama wasn't willing to take the little girl on, there was only one other option. There were other families in the town who might accommodate her, but none I trusted enough to care for her the way she deserved. Truda was much like Mama, kind if somewhat abrupt at times, but Mateusz was gentler, quite jolly and jovial, and he had inherited a textiles factory from his father, so he provided my sister a very comfortable life in the town. They lived in a large house on the best street in town, and even had electric lights in their home, something I was very jealous of because we still managed with oil lamps at home. I knew Truda and Mateusz wanted to have children, but even after years of marriage, she was yet to fall pregnant. They had the resources and space to provide Amelia with a ready-made family, but I was nervous to ask it of them. Truda was 8 years older than me, and we were hardly close. There was just no alternative, no matter how hard I racked my brain. So I walked the handful of blocks from the square to Truda's house with a weeping Amelia in tow. We turned into her beautiful street, a narrow cobblestoned laneway lined with mature sweet chestnut trees. This neighborhood was flush with two-story homes, and flower patches were in bloom all along the sidewalk. Many of the homes in her street had cars, still a novelty to me then, and it had been the very first street in the town to get electricity. Perhaps with such big homes and such a small roadway, that street might have felt cramped, except that the narrow street spilled into a huge parkland at the end. The park was a paradise of soft green grass and still more chestnut trees, a space centered by an immense square pond where ducks swam and children played in the summer. I thought my sister would come quickly from the town square, but time began to pass, and I started to worry that she'd return to my parents' home after all. Amelia and I sat on the steps at Truda's house and watched as a crowd began to file into a house across the road. That's when I realized why Truda and Mateusz were standing with the mayor's wife at the square. They were neighbors. My sister would surely be there at that house, comforting the grieving widow and her large brood of children. I wouldn't dare to go there myself, so all I could do was to sit with Amelia and wait. She cried endlessly, and sometimes she shook so hard I had to press her against my chest to hold her still. "Be brave, Amelia," I said at first, because that's what I imagined my mama or Truda would have said if they were there. But it felt like such a cruel request. After that, I didn't say anything. Instead, I cried with her until the sleeves of my dress were soaked with both of our tears. When Truda finally came along the sidewalk, she stopped dead in her tracks and surveyed the spectacle before her. I drew in a deep breath and prepared to blurt out the sales pitch I had been planning in my mind. But Truda quickly resumed her path toward the stoop. Her steps were falling faster now, and her chin was high, her gaze determined. For a moment, I feared she was going to turn us away, especially when she stepped all the way around us and opened the front door.
"Come on then, little one," she said from the doorway. "Let's get your bed organized."
"You'll take her?" I choked.
"Of course we will take her," Truda said stiffly. "Emilia is our daughter now. Is she not, Mateusz?"
Mateusz simply bent down, scooped Amelia up, and cradled her in his arms like she was a baby, just as he'd done when he rescued her from the town 2 days earlier. She was far too old and too large to be carried in that way, but she nestled into his large frame anyway.
"Do you need me to take you home, Alina?" he asked. "I can, but you'll need to wait until we get Amelia settled. Or you can leave now, and you will be home before dark."
Amelia pressed her face into Mateusz's shoulder now and wrapped her arms around his neck, and suddenly I felt like an intruder in the early moments of this brand new family I had somehow helped to create. I shook my head and looked once more to my sister.
"Thank you,"
I whispered, but I was completely overcome with gratitude and relief. A sob broke from my lips and I said it again. "Thank you." Truda was, typically, embarrassed by my overt display of emotion. She waved my thanks away impatiently, but her eyes greedily soaked in the sight of Amelia in her husband's arms.
"Go home," Truda said quietly. "And be careful, please, Alina. This is the last time I want to see you wandering around the township on your own. It's not safe anymore."
I ran the entire way home, up the path through the woods to the hill and straight back down to the house. By the time I arrived, dusk was falling and I was completely exhausted. My brothers were bringing the animals into the barn, and we shared a glance as I came through the gate. Felipe's eyes were red, as if he'd been crying all afternoon. When I threw open the door to our home, Mama and Father were both standing at the dining room table, their hands looped beneath it as if they'd been shifting it. That made no sense at all. Our furniture had always been in the exact same place for as long as I could remember. I shook myself, as if I was hallucinating one more nonsensical happening in a day that had been the very worst kind of surreal. But the image didn't fade.
"What are you doing?" I blurted.
Mama's gaze narrowed at me.
None of your business, child. Where did you take her?
Her tone was stiff, but her gaze concerned.
Truta, I said,
and Mama nodded, satisfied, and she stepped away from the table back toward the pot-bellied stove where a pot of soup was simmering.
I should have told you to do that. I was too panicked. I didn't think. Good girl.
What did the commander say today? I asked her.
And the softness disappeared from her gaze altogether as she flung a scowl back toward me.
He is not a commander, she said flatly. Don't ever name those animals as if they are human. Don't give them the power or the prestige of honored titles. The pigs are invaders, nothing more.
What did the invader say?
I asked weakly, and Mama avoided my gaze.
You need soup. You must eat and stay strong. These months will be hard until we find a way to defeat them.
Mama,
I pleaded with her,
I need to know.
All you need to know is what you saw today, Alina,
Father said, his voice stiff.
They did not say much more than a whole lot of posturing and warning us that they will be taking the produce. Eventually, they plan to take the farms for German settlers. This is nothing your mother and I did not expect. We are a tough people. We will ride this out and hope for the best.
Take the farm? I gasped.
Their plans are immense, unpractical. This displacement will not happen overnight. And as long as the farm remains productive, perhaps we will be spared.
But what will happen to us if they take the farm? I choked.
Mama clucked her tongue and waved toward the table and chairs.
Enough, Elena. We can't know what's coming, or even when. All we can do is try our best to keep our heads down.
I didn't want soup. I didn't want the hot tea Mama made me. I really didn't want the vodka Father pressed into my hands and eventually forced me to drink. I wanted to feel safe again. But our home had been violated, and Alexei had died in cold blood right in front of my eyes. And every time I closed my eyes, I saw it happen all over again. That night, I lay in my bed and I stared at the window. Scattered clouds hung low above our house, and I watched the slight curve of the moon when it appeared in the gaps between them. I'd taken the vodka so reluctantly, but once the burning in my throat passed, I felt it loosen my limbs and my mind, and I finally stopped shaking and relaxed into my bed. At last, I let my mind turn to Tomas, and I wondered how he would hear about Alexei's fate. Did the mail still work? Could I send him a letter? Should I send him a letter? And then, finally, from the fog of shock in my mind, the most terrifying thought of all gradually rose and grew louder until it consumed my thoughts entirely. Tomas was in Warsaw, studying at university to become a doctor, just like his father before him. Alexei had just been killed because he was a doctor. What if Tomas was already dead too? My heart began to race, and the trembling started all over again. I sat up and opened my top drawer, then fished around to find the ring at the bottom. I squeezed it tightly in my palm, so tightly that it left a deep impression on my skin. It was exactly what I wanted. I needed my hopes to mark me and for my dreams to become a part of my body. Something tangible that could not be lost or taken. After the generalized brutality of the early days of the occupation, the Nazi attention soon took on a narrower focus. There was a thriving Jewish community in Chibinya, and as weeks turned into months, it was the Jewish folk who bore the brunt of the violence. There was widespread violence and theft against the Jews, both by Nazis and then, to my father's horror, by gangs of opportunistic locals who operated openly in the daylight. Their mission was at least in part to express solidarity with the occupying forces. Once we learned that Jan Gołoszewski had participated in such a gang, Father told Felipe and I that we were no longer allowed to see Justyna. I was too scared to disobey, but Felipe began sneaking out at night to meet with her in the fields. A curfew had been set by the Nazi forces, and we weren't supposed to leave the house after dark. So when Felipe refused to stop his midnight trips to see his love, Father was forced to relent.
Justyna may visit here during the daylight hours, or you may meet her at the boundaries between the farms. It's not her fault that her father is who he is. But I won't allow my children to step inside that bastard's home.
The situation in Chibinya continued to deteriorate. Jewish businesses and then homes were confiscated altogether. Then whole families were forced to shift into a Jewish area and sent to work for the invaders. There were restrictions on travel and marriage. And then we heard the very first rumors of friends from within the town being shot, sometimes for attempting to flee, but often for no real reason at all. The oppression came in waves, each one more determined than the last, setting a new baseline of normal for the stunned Jews in town and those of us watching nearby. My Roman Catholic family had lived side by side with the Jews in Chibinya forever. We'd been to school with their children, sold them our produce, and relied on goods from their stores. So as the noose around the neck of our Jewish community began to wind tighter, the sheer helplessness the rest of us felt affected everyone in different ways. Mama and Father would curse the invaders, but reacted almost violently to any suggestion that we were anything other than helpless bystanders to the tragedy unfolding before us. They were determined that if we kept our heads down, we could stay under the radar and remain safe ourselves. But Stanislav and Felipe were 18-year-old boys, right on the edge of manhood, flooded with testosterone and an optimistic belief that justice was achievable. They'd wait until Mama and Father were out of earshot, then have intense discussions about growing rumors of a resistance. The twins traded hints of hope, spurring one another on, until I was absolutely terrified one or both of them would disappear into the night and get themselves killed.
"Don't do anything rash," I pleaded with Felipe at every chance I got.
He was the more sensitive of the twins. Mama sometimes said that Stanislav had been born a hardened old man. But Felipe was softer, vastly less arrogant, and I knew if I could convince him to remain cautious, Stanislav would likely follow.
"Mama and Father think that if we keep our heads down, the Nazis will leave us alone," Felipe said to me one morning as we collected eggs together in the chicken yard.
"Is that so foolish?" I asked him, and he laughed bitterly.
"It doesn't work that way, Alina. Hatred spreads. It doesn't burn out with time. Someone needs to stand up and stop it. You watch, sister. When they're done with the Jews, it will be our turn again. Besides, even if we could ride out the war with our heads down and we sat back while the Nazis worked all of our Jewish friends to death, what kind of Poland could be rebuilt once they were gone? Those people are as important to this country as we are. We're better off dying with honor than sitting back to watch our countrymen suffer," he said.
"The father of your girlfriend would disagree with everything you just said," I muttered, and Felipe sighed heavily.
"Jan is a bigoted pig, Alina. It's hard enough to be civil to that man, even on my good days. I can only force myself to be polite to him, because if I wasn't, I'd lose Justyna. And I love her.
But don't you see?
It is because of men like Jan that we must find a way to rise up. We owe it to our sisters and brothers."
Felipe's rage only intensified once we had our first direct encounter with Nazi harassment. A group of SS officers stopped Truda and Emilia on the street outside of their home when they were walking to the factory to see Mateusz one day.
"I didn't understand what was happening,"
Truda whispered to Mama and me as we watched Emilia sit sullenly in the corner. Felipe and Stani were trying to make her laugh, but she was too shocked to even react to their antics. One of the officers measured her height and said she is tall for her age and her eyes are green, so she is close enough to Arian and they should take her.
Take her where?
I asked hesitantly.
I don't know,
Truda admitted with a shrug.
But clever Emilia was calling me Mama, and my hair is so dark.
They looked at me and said her hair would get darker as she got older, and then they told us to go.
Yesterday, they took Nadia Novak's daughter,
Felipe murmured from his position on the floor. He looked up at us, rage simmering in his eyes. Nadia was Justina's aunt, the sister of her mother Ola, and I'd met Nadia's daughter Paulina. She was a tiny slip of a thing, only 3 or 4 years old, with a halo of blonde curls and bright blue eyes.
It's called the Lebensborn Program. The SS are assessing each child in the township for their suitability to be taken from their families and Germanized. The soldiers told Nadia that Paulina will be placed with a German foster family and given a new name, so she has a chance of growing up to be racially pure. Nadia refused to let Paulina go, so the soldiers tore her from Nadia's arms. Ola and Justina are there today, comforting her. Nadia is distraught.
Oh, that poor thing, Mama gasped, clasping her hands in front of her chest. Her husband was killed in the bombings, too. She has suffered so much already.
I told you, didn't I?
Felipe said, looking right at me. His nostrils had flared and his shoulders were locked hard.
I told you it was only a matter of time before they came for us, too. This is our punishment because we laid down and let them torture our Jewish brothers and sisters, Alina. Now they steal our children. And God only knows what will happen to that little one now that she's away from her family.
Emilia was listening to all of this, her eyes growing wider, her jaw going slack.
Felipe,
I whispered, glancing at her anxiously.
Please, not now.
Stanislav broke the tension. He leaped playfully at Felipe, who cried out in surprise. Just as he went to throw Stani away, Felipe looked at Emilia. A startled smile had broken on her face, and so Felipe went limp. Stani had clearly been expecting a wrestling match and didn't seem to know what to do with Felipe now that he'd pinned him, so I quickly skipped across the room to join the tangle of bodies on the floor. I grinned at Emilia and locked my hands into claws, then tickled my strapping young brothers. They both looked at me blankly, but when Emilia howled with laughter, they played along too. When the time came for Truda and Emilia to leave, Felipe and Stani insisted on chaperoning them. As we watched the foursome walk up into the woods to cross the hill into town, Mama shook her head.
That boy worries me,
she murmured.
I knew exactly which boy she meant.
After that day, I became Felipe's shadow. The occupation was months old by then, and I'd heard nothing at all of Tomas, so I had little to fill my thoughts but fears for him and terror that my brother was about to go get himself killed, and only one of those things could I control. I kept myself busy by following Felipe around the farm, waiting for any opportunity to convince him to stay safe. I really thought the biggest risk to Felipe's safety was the temptation to join the resistance, but he never even got the chance to go seeking danger, because soon enough it came to us. I was blindsided by the sound of a truck rumbling on the road beside our property one morning when I was in the field with Mama harvesting potatoes. The soldier in the passenger's seat stared right at us as they passed, and a sound escaped my mouth that was almost a shriek.
Mama!
Stay calm, Mama said quietly. Whatever you do, Alina, do not panic.
The blood was pounding through my body, echoing in my ears. My hands were shaking so hard I had to rest them against the soil to hold them still. In the end, I sat on my heels and I stared in horror as the truck came to a stop right at the gate to our farm. 4 soldiers stepped from the truck and approached the barn where Father was working. I couldn't hear them speaking. We were just too far away. It was a very quick visit, The soldiers handed Father a piece of paper and left, so I told myself everything was fine. I watched the truck as it continued along the road toward the Goloshevsky house. Mama suddenly stood and began to run to the house, and I set my basket aside to follow her. When we reached Father, we found him reading the notice, leaning heavily against the doorframe of the barn. Father seemed stupefied. He was blinking slowly, and the color had drained entirely from his face.
"What is it?" Mama demanded, and she snatched the paper from his hand.
As she read it, she made a little noise in the back of her throat.
"Mama, Father," I croaked, "what is wrong?"
"Go fetch your brothers from the other field," Father said dully. "We need to have a talk."
We sat around the table and each of us took our turn to hold the paper. It was a summons. All families in our district who had children over the age of 12 would be required to send them for labor assignment. I was too upset to read the whole thing. In fact, every time I tried, my vision clouded with tears. Still, I was simply determined to keep a grip on some kind of optimism, or better still, to find a loophole.
"There has to be a way around it," I told my family.
My brothers shared an impatient glance, but I ignored them and pressed harder to find a way out of the mess.
"They can't make us leave our family and our home. They can't."
"Alina!"
Felipe cut me off sharply.
"These are the same people who shot Alexei and the mayor in front of the entire town. These are the same soldiers who are making the Jewish children in the town work from sunup to sundown. The same pigs who think nothing of beating women and children to death if they disobey. The same men who took little Paulina Novak just because her hair is blonde. Do you really think they are going to hesitate to take a bunch of teenagers away in case we get homesick?"
I went to bed early that night and closed the door between my bed and the rest of the house, and I looked around my little room, my little world. My parents had split our tiny house into three rooms, although by today's standards, two of those rooms would be laughably small, no more than closets. We were farmers, peasants in the local vernacular, people who made only just enough from our land to support ourselves, and during dry years, not a single shaft of wheat we didn't desperately need. So many times since Tomas left, I'd been so desperate to flee that house, to run to Warsaw to be with him. But that was when I thought I was walking away from my family into Tomas's waiting arms. An entirely different scenario to this one, where I was being torn away and sent to hostile strangers in a hostile land. I was existing here at the farm in a broken world, propelled out of bed each day only by the fact that every sunrise at least had the potential to bring news of Tomas's safety. If the Nazis took me away, how would he ever find me? How would I ever know what had become of him? The months that had passed since his last letter had felt close to unbearable. How could I survive if the not knowing became a permanent state? I lay on my bed, and I wrapped my arms around myself, and I tried so hard to be brave. But I just kept picturing myself so far away from my family, isolated in a place where I didn't speak the language, and where I would no longer be the beloved and somewhat sheltered youngest child, but instead, a vulnerable young woman on her own. Eventually, I closed my eyes, and I fell into an exhausted sleep. But I awoke some time later to hushed whispers from my parents in the living room. I couldn't quite make out what they were saying, so slipped out of bed to stand at the door.
"Stanislav is the strongest. We must keep him. We cannot run the farm without him. At the very least, we keep Felipe. He has no common sense, and he will run his mouth off if we let him go."
"No, Alina is tiny, and she's weak and too pretty. She is but a child. If we send Alina, she will never survive. We must keep her here."
"But if we keep her, the farm will never survive."
I opened the door, and my parents both jumped in their chairs. My father looked away, but Mama turned to me and said impatiently, "Back to bed."
"What are you talking about?"
I asked her.
Nothing. It is none of your concern.
Hope blossomed in my chest. This was such an enticing sensation that I had to press a little harder, even though I knew I'd likely be shouted at for doing so.
Did you find a way for us to stay?
Back to bed, Mama said, and as I'd expected, her tone left no room for argument.
There was no sleeping after that, and later, when I heard my parents pull up the sofa that served as their bed, I waited a while until they fell silent. Then I sneaked past their bed to the boys' tiny room at the other end of the house. My brothers were wide awake, laying top to tail on the sofa they shared. When I entered the room, Felipe sat up and opened his arms to me.
What is going on? Can we stay after all?
He pulled away from me to stare at me in disbelief.
Didn't you read the notice?
I read most of it, I lied,
and he sighed heavily.
One of us will be given a permit to stay here and help them run the farm.
Mama and father have to choose, Felipe told me softly.
He brushed my hair back from my face, then added,
But to ask them to choose between their children is a cruelty that we will not tolerate. Stani and I will go. You will have to work hard, Alina. And you are lazy, so it won't be easy. But it is safer for you to stay here.
But I'm going to marry Tomas soon, and then I'll move to Warsaw, I said stubbornly. Alina, Stanislav whispered impatiently. There is no university left at Warsaw. I heard that the professors have all been imprisoned or executed, and most of the students joined the Wehrmacht. Tomas is either in prison or working with those monsters. But it doesn't even matter which. You're not moving away.
I was indignant at the very idea that Tomas would ever align himself with the Nazi troops.
How dare you?
Hush, Alina, Felipe said tiredly. No one knows where Tomas is, not for sure, so don't get upset.
Then he glanced at me and he added slowly,
But if you stay here, he has a chance of finding you if he manages to get out of the city to come home.
I'd thought the same thing myself. For just a moment, I clung to the idea greedily, but then I remembered what the trade-off was. I tried to imagine my life without the twins, but the very thought of it filled me with loneliness.
But I don't want you to go away,
I whispered tearfully, and Stanislav sighed.
So, Alina, instead, will you go to the work farm for us then? Miles away from Mama and father, all on your own?
In the end, the boys would not be deterred. When the day came for them to leave, Mama, father, and I walked them into Chyabinya to the train station. Mateusz, Truda, and Emilia met us there, and when Emilia saw me, she skipped to my side and smiled sadly.
This is just like when we said goodbye to Tomas, she whispered.
I nodded, but I was distracted, absorbing the shocking scene before me. It was an overcast day, just like Tomas's departure, and we were at the train station again, but Emilia was very wrong, because I was immediately aware that this moment was something altogether new. This time, no one was waiting on the platform to send their loved ones on to some exciting adventure. None of these children were leaving Chyabinya to learn or to explore. They were being stolen from us. To the invaders, they were nothing more than a resource to be exploited. But those of us left behind knew that a part of the soul of our district was being torn away. Even Nadia Novak, who had already lost her husband in the bombings, then had her precious Paulina taken for Germanization, stood on that platform and wailed loudly as she said goodbye to her three oldest teenagers. Nadia joined a sea of other mothers who sobbed with equal grief and terror, and a crowd of fathers who cleared their throats compulsively and dabbed frantically at their eyes to hide any hint of moisture. The young people stood woodenly for the most part. Some of the very young ones cried, but it wasn't the unrestrained emotion we saw in their mothers. These were tears of shock and disbelief. I got the sense that even once the train arrived at the work farms, those young people would take weeks to accept the reality of their situations. And that would have been me, but for my brothers. I'd been relieved since the decision was made that I would stay. But as I faced the consequences of my easy acceptance of my brother's nobility, I was swamped in a wave of grief that threatened to knock me to my knees. Emilia tugged my hand suddenly, and I looked down at her to find she was staring at me intently.
"Do you think Tomas is still alive?"
she asked me. I blinked at her, surprised both at the question and the resigned tone with which she asked it. I shook myself mentally and forced myself to focus because there was something not at all right about such a grown-up, pessimistic tone coming from sweet little Emilia. I ruffled her hair and I said firmly,
"Of course he is. He's alive and he's well and he's doing everything he can to get back to us." "How can you be so sure?" "He promised me, silly, and Tomas would never lie to me."
Her sharp green gaze didn't waver from mine, and it took every bit of strength I had not to look away. I wouldn't break the stare, because I feared if I did, she'd see right through me. Was I as sure as all that? Not at all. But for all of the desperation in our lives that day, I wanted to save Emilia the one small trauma of doubting her beloved big brother. She nodded suddenly, abruptly, and went back to staring at the assembled crowd around us. All too soon, announcements came that it was time for the young people to make their way to the train. Felipe stepped toward me and enveloped me in a bear hug. "Look after Mama and Father, Alina. Work hard."
"I wish you could stay," I whispered.
My guilt was so palpable in that moment, I couldn't even make myself look him in the eye.
"I couldn't stay. Not when the alternative was for you to go," he said gently.
Then he kissed my forehead and whispered against my hair,
"Be brave, little sister. You are so much more than you know."
Stanny approached me as the tears filled my eyes. He kissed my cheek too, but he was silent, even as he embraced our parents. Father stood frozen, his muscles locked, his teeth set hard. Mama silently cried. Truda was clutching Mateus's arm so tightly her fingers were white, but her expression was solemn. The boys gave a simultaneous nod, and they walked away to join the line to fill the train. They kept their chins high, and they both managed a smile and a wave back toward us just before they disappeared from our view. I was awed by their courage, and bewildered that even that moment didn't seem to faze them one little bit. Of course, they must have been terrified. They were only boys, and all of the things that had scared me about the forced labor arrangement would have been equally overwhelming to them, too. Neither one spoke much German. Neither one had ever lived out of home before. I knew the very act of hiding their fear was one of sacrifice, just like the decision to go in my place. They were good people. The best people. I still think about my big brothers. I sometimes wonder if I would have done anything different that day, if only I'd known that within a year, they'd both be dead, and that those quiet moments by the train station would be the very last time I ever saw them.
Chapter 6 Alice. Mom has turned Babcia's retirement home unit upside down, but she can't find the box. Now she's headed back to her house. She has some of Babcia and Pa's things in storage. It's been a few hours, and she'll be a while yet, but Eddie is pressing the lunch button on his iPad dozens of times a minute, and it's driving me, Babcia, and the nurses insane. I turned the sound down, but Eddie turned it straight back up, just like Babcia did earlier. One of the nurses quite gently asked if I could take the iPad off him, but it's his voice and his ears, so I refused. We're actually lucky because now that it's lunchtime, he'll eat soup or yogurt. But also supremely unlucky because given the fiasco in the store this morning, I have neither on hand. Eddie simply needs a can of soup, or better still, some tubes of Go-Gurt, if we can find some with the right label. I have to call Wade. I have to convince him to come from work via a store and to bring something Eddie can eat, or better still, to come and take Eddie home. The reason I don't want to do it is that I already know how this conversation is going to go. It's an emergency, I'll say. I wouldn't have asked if I had an alternative, but I can't leave Babcia alone. She's distressed enough as it is, and I don't know how much longer Mom is going to be, but Eddie desperately needs to eat. Wade will make all the right noises, and then there'll be some impressive reason why he can't help. He did say he had meetings, so I imagine he'll refer back to that pre-made excuse again. I think about just putting up with the endless robotic demands for lunch, 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 and waiting, but Eddie looks so frustrated, like he's about to explode, actually. And now that I think about it, it's a bona fide miracle we've made it this far today with only one meltdown. I sigh and dial Wade.
Honey, he answers on the first ring. I've been so worried. How are things going?
Things are terrible, I admit. Babcia can't speak, and I don't think she can understand us. She's been using Eddie's iPad, and she's told us she needs a box of photos from home, but Mom can't find it. And Eddie didn't get his yogurt this morning because there's new packaging on the Go-Gurt at the Publix, and he had this meltdown, and now he's starving, so another one is coming, and I can't do this by myself today. I need your help. I know you said you were busy.
I'm so sorry, honey. I have these meetings.
There is no one else I can call, Wade. I've raised my voice, and Eddie and Babcia both look at me in surprise. Even if they don't understand the words, the volume apparently speaks for itself. I wince as I offer them an apologetic shrug, then take a deep breath to calm myself a little.
I can't take him home, Alice, my husband says a little stiffly. I just have too much.
Don't worry, Wade. I'm not asking for anything unrealistic, like you spending an afternoon alone with your son, I say. Then I hear his sharp intake of breath, and I realize we're about to argue. Again. Probably because he's being an ass, and that comment I just made fell somewhere on the spectrum between mean and bitchy, so it's guaranteed to get a defensive rise out of him. I close my eyes and aim for a much more conciliatory tone as I say, I'm only asking you to go pick up some tins of soup or some Go-Gurt if you can find the old packaging. Bring them to me here at the hospital. I'll handle everything else. My tone shifts, and now I'm begging him. Please, Wade. Please. He sighs, and in my mind, I can see him in his office on the phone. He'll be sitting stiffly because I'm irritating him, and he'll have instantly mussed up his hair because he's upset at how I just spoke to him. Even now, in the awful silence as I wait for him to speak, I know he'll be repeatedly running his hand over his hair, and when the exasperation gets too much, he'll rest his hand against the back of his neck and slump. But just as I can picture this with perfect clarity after so many years with Wade, I also know he's going to do what I asked, because if he wasn't, he'd have snapped right back at me and we'd have wound up this call with one or both of us hanging up in anger.
I'll come now.
If you go to the store near your office, they might have stock of the Go-Gurt with the old labels. I hesitate, then ask cautiously, you know what that looked like, right? I'll text you the image. Same for the soup. You have to get the right soup.
I'm not an idiot, Alice, he says impatiently.